Cher Bernard, chers collègues, mesdames, messieurs, merci beaucoup pour avoir m'invité. Pour moi, donner la lecture dans une institution que Docet Omnia, qui voit pas de bornes entre les sciences comme un rêve, vous verrez pourquoi. Malheureusement, je ne pourrai pas continuer la conférence dans la langue de cette institution parce que mon français est un peu rouillé. Alors, on continue en anglais avec un accent grec lourd. This talk is about algorithms, and I hope you know that algorithms are one of the most important subjects of the world. This talk is about use of algorithms as a tool in philosophy of science, as a lens, as a way of looking at other sciences outside computer science in a way that transforms them and reveals unanticipated truths in these sciences. And this has happened in many sciences, such as mathematics, statistical physics, quantum physics, economics and social sciences, and so on. And this today I'm going to tell you about evolution. I'm grateful that Bernard mentioned that I also write novel stories because this talk you can see it as a bunch of stories. Okay, so it's going to be about evolution, and one thing that probably all of you know is that evolution did not start with Darwin. It was well established way before Darwin, and it was a very, very widespread belief among natural scientists. But perhaps you didn't know that one of the great evolutionists before Darwin was Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. Of course, there was. Perhaps the greatest evolutionist before Darwin was a Frenchman, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, greatest zoologist of his time, who, unfortunately, he's remembered, especially in the English-speaking literature, for his greatest mistake, which is reflecting a belief among peasants of the time. He believed that acquired traits such as traumata can be inherited. So we'll come back to Jean-Baptiste. Perhaps you didn't know this is a talk about how computer science thought can inform evolution, and it's very appropriate to mention that the great grandfather of computer science, Charles Babbage, was actually one of the early evolutionists. And he said this, okay? So, you know, he didn't say these words, but believe me, he said this, okay? Right? It's an interesting fact to remember. And then, of course, Darwin came with his amazing book, what he offered, you know, the way he advanced, basically, he created evolution as a science. And the reason is that he provided two things. One is common ancestry. He was the first one to actually articulate that all of life comes from a few species, he said, but he meant one species. Most importantly, he came up with the mechanism for evolution, which is the natural selection mechanism. Okay, and The Origin of Species, the book I'm talking about, is of course it's a book that I think everybody should read, because we're all scientists. We all want to write our arguments in the most persuasive way possible, and no argument was ever written more persuasively than Darwin's argument, okay, and by Darwin himself. That's why it took him 30 years to write. Okay? And so at Berkeley, they teach the Origin of Species. I taught a course in evolution 2 years ago, and we read the Origin of Species, among other books, in it. But Berkeley teaches it in an undergraduate course on rhetoric, because it is the most amazing opus of scientific rhetoric, I believe. Another thing is that Darwin never stopped. You know, Darwin wrote another 30 books, but he never stopped working on the Origin, and he edited it 6 times during his life. Actually, on the web, you can find actual phylogenetic tree of these editions, okay, and where basically you see what is different from one to the next. And what is perhaps the most interesting is in following these differences is the number of mentions of the word God, which goes like this, okay. So it has a harmonic of two, and if you think about it, harmonic of two betrays an internal conflict, okay. So you know that's. In any event, what is also very interesting about the Origin of Species that Darwin worked on it for 30 years, and probably he would have worked on it for 60 years if it was not for this man here, Wallace. Sometimes I don't know which of the two is Darwin. I think Wallace. Wallace was a contemporary of Darwin, another great natural scientist, and. He was some kind of Indiana Jones of natural science at the time. His modus operandi was that he would visit Borneo, come back with in a ship full of crates with orangutans and snakes, sell them to the British aristocracy, and thus finance his next trip, maybe to Malaysia. Okay, so. Precisely those at that time there was he was in Malaysia, he was down with malaria actually, and barren with fever. He woke up one day and he had natural selection. He had thought of natural selection, and he said, that's it, that's the missing piece. Evolution is now explained. And think about him. He's stuck in bed in Malaysia, okay? So what he did is the natural thing to do. He wrote a letter, explained his idea to the natural scientist he respected the most, and this natural scientist happened to be Darwin, okay? So I was not there when Darwin opened this letter, but I can imagine that he dropped from his chair. But he handled everything with amazing and characteristic integrity. What he did is he congregated a meeting of the Linnean Society, which I guess meant the Biological Society, the Royal Biological Society at the time. And in that meeting, two letters were read. One is the letter by Wallace, and the other one is a letter that Darwin had written about the same time to an Oxford professor explaining his theory. If you use a search engine to the Darwin Wallace papers, you'll find them. They're available. There are 5 pages total. There is absolutely no excuse not to read them. Okay, because they're fascinating reading. One very interesting, because again, this talk is about computer science arguments and ideas in evolution. One fascinating aspect of Darwin's letter is that it's about 3 pages long. One page, probably half the argument, is spent on explaining what exponential growth is, something that is common, that is, nobody ever explains, has trouble explaining exponential growth to the man in the street today. But back then it was near impossible because a Victorian English man could not, you know, had never seen exponential growth. Now it's commonplace. The reason, of course, in thinking about exponential growth, Darwin was influenced by Malthus, the economist. The point is that why did he need exponential growth? And the reason why exponential growth was central to his argument is the following. That once you, one, everybody is impressed by what exponential growth means, that after 10 generations you have a million and after 30 generations you have a trillion, immediately you think, why don't I see this in nature? And the reason is, Darwin says, that life is tough and only the fit survive. Okay, so that was the beginning of his argument for natural selection. In any event, amazing argument. Still, many questions are left unasked. How does novelty arise? For example, biologists now are very apt at explaining, for example, how from a primitive eye you get to the falcon's eye. But it's much harder to understand how from no eye you get an eye, how a new idea emerges. Okay, so, and that's, of course, how eusociality emerges in ants. That's an incredibly much more complicated question. And the second one is, what is the role of sex? Remember, docet omnia, even sex, okay, right? So that's... what is the role of sex? You know, Darwin himself says in about a dozen times in the Origin that he does not understand the role of sex. Okay, in fact, sex was detrimental to his argument. Okay, for the following reason: that sex was understood in those times as sort of mixing of two liquids so that another liquid comes out. Okay, so the point is that if you mix it liquid a lot, okay, what comes out is a nondescript color of liquid, right? I mean, so how come we see all this variety around us? Okay, so it seemed to go well against Darwin, so he didn't touch it, it's still the role of sex is not understood today. Okay, and I'll come back to both of these questions. After Darwin, perhaps the most important conceptual contribution to evolution was done by a wise man that whose name happened to be Wiseman, he basically used a computer science metaphor that did not exist then to explain. To essentially combat Lamarckianism, okay? So, you know, why is it's impossible to inherit an acquired trait, an acquired character? And his argument, again paraphrased, is that the mapping from genotype to phenotype is one way. You can compute it one way, but not the other, okay? So if it's one way, it means that there is no way that once you break a leg, the breakage of the leg can make its way to your gonads and change the DNA in precisely the appropriate way that will break the leg of your progeny. Okay, so that's I think a brilliant argument, an amazing conceptual contribution. And then genetics happened. Mendel in 66, shortly after Darwin, came up with. With his discrete traits, discrete characters, and the laws of inheritance. And we are all scientists. We are all very impatient for our work to have an impact. And in this particular case, in the 35 first years after Mendel's, how many citations did this paper have? Okay, you know, so the answer is this is one of the most important papers in the history of science, by the way. The answer is three. Okay, and I have not read these three papers, but those who have write that these three authors had not understood Mendel at all. Okay, But 35 years later, in the beginning of the 20th century, an explosion happened regarding Mendelism, and genetics became en vogue. There was, as I told you, Darwin, not explicitly, but implicitly in his book, he understood genetic characters or if you wish, genes as continuous. Okay, because this seemed to be at direct conflict with what Mendel had found. Okay, and so people said, either this is true or this, and we have to find out which one it is. And they were divided into two back camps, the Mendelians and the Darwinians, genetics versus biometricists, and so on. And this crisis, scientific crisis in evolution, lasted for about 20 years. And if you like mathematics and you want one example of a contribution of mathematics to be proud of, I believe that one of the greatest contributions of mathematics to science had been to resolve this conflict, okay? Because this conflict was resolved by the work of three mathematicians, Fisher, Wright, and Haldane, and actually a group of probably a dozen mathematicians, of which these were the three most prominent. And basically, they came up what is called by the modern synthesis in biology, in evolution. By the modern synthesis, basically, they created a model, and now that I've seen Bernard's lecture, I'm sorry I did that, but I have taken out all equations from this lecture. But they came up with an equation basically, and the equation says the following, and I will let you reproduce it in your mind. So you know, it's rather obvious. Imagine a large, let's say, infinite population in a species. And they all have a number of genes, and the genes come in different variants or alleles. And by picking one allele from every gene, or two alleles from every gene, if it's a diploid organism like we are, you get a genotype, a particular individual, a particular organism. And now, the genotypes in this population, they have a particular frequency. The question is, from one generation to the next, how do these frequencies change? Okay, and that's an interesting question. What are the data? The only data in this equation are what is called the fitness of every genotype, because presumably the basic assumption is that every genotype, every particular individual, has a particular fitness, and fitness is the expected number of progeny, the expected number of children that this person is going to create. Okay? When you say the survival of the fittest, is the survival of the individuals who have what it takes to make a lot of children. Okay? So if you take, you know, if you have these frequencies and fitness, you can, and then you also make assumptions about sexual recombination. In other words, that half of your genes come from mom, half of your genes come from dad. All these put together, they give you a rather complicated to write, but conceptually very simple equation. It's a dynamical system, if you wish, which tells you how genotypes evolve from one generation to the next, and so on. Okay, so these are the Fisher-Wright equations. And they are our way of understanding evolution until now, and these are the equations on which the rest of my talk will be based. The many questions are left unanswered. Incidentally, I have to tell you the following. I taught this course two years ago about evolution, and one of the books we read was a standard textbook on evolution that every beginning graduate student in evolution reads by Grauer and Lee. And I read, you know, so when we read the introduction, I asked the class, what did you find amazing about the introduction? Here's what I found amazing. That if you read an introduction to a graduate text, the most commonly mentioned word is the word problem. Because the author wants to convince you that this field is full of problems, open problems. And therefore, if you read this text, then you have a lot of choices for your thesis problem. Okay, you know, so that's how the marketing graduate textbook works. Okay, but this particular graduate textbook did not mention once the word problem. Okay, and the reason, sadly, I think, is the following. that in the United States, evolution is a science in siege, under siege, okay, sort of, you know, by the religious extreme. And as a result, you don't want somebody to get on a pulpit and say, even Professor Lee at the University of Chicago admits in page 8 of his textbook that there are problems with the theory of evolution. You know, so every student of evolution knows that these are important problems, but sort of, you know, but they say sort of, you know, in private, not in public. You know, so or they use different, slightly different word. Okay, so let's come, you know, speaking about computer algorithmic insights. Less Valiant started studying evolution a few years back, and he asked the following question: how do you find a 3 billion long string in 3 billion years? Okay, so that's a very interesting question. Okay, you know, computer science cannot do that. Incidentally, a great French mathematician and early computer scientist, Marcos Ichemberger, asked exactly the same question 40 years before Valiant. Okay, so, you know, he was very disbelieving about the power, explanatory power of current evolutionary thought to explain how come this. You know, there is a computer science, there is a more mainstream computer science way of asking this question that I like, and that's the following. You know, in other words, that's the disbelief. Look around you and you say, how come this, you know, can this crude mechanism achieve this? Okay, I mean, you know, this is very common. Even Darwin did it. And had his doubts. And here is, I think, the computer science way, I was telling Bernard over lunch. What algorithm could have produced all this that we see around us in only 10 to the 12, a trillion steps? That's how many generations we have from Eve to now. Okay, you know, from the first organism to now. Okay, and 10 to the 12 is not too many steps. Okay, just to give you a comparison, your cell phone does so many steps in an hour. Okay, so in so many steps, in so many generations, we have to believe that there is an algorithm that produces what you see around us. Okay, it's a long, you know, it's not easy, right? So in any event, so we come back to that, and there is Valiant's theory of evolution, which in some sense was he asked the question which traits can evolve, and he classified it as a special case of a particularly weak form of learning called statistical learning. And as a result, did not add much explanatory power to evolution, okay? Because it sort of showed that that evolution is, incidentally, one of the weaknesses of this approach in my mind is that Les Valiant did not use sex, did not, you know, so he sex actually in all of evolutionary thought is considered as an extra bonus, okay? And basically, the whole problem is to explain why is it a bonus and not a detriment, because it is a detriment. Okay, so, you know, in many ways sex is a disadvantage. Okay, let me explain. So there are many ways, there are many ways to see it. First of all, there are all these amazing complicated mechanisms and genetic mechanisms and organs and behaviors and risks and energy that goes wasted and all that for what? Okay, so, you know, imagine a young lady who has two children and now looks at these two children and thinks, these two children together, they have one copy of my genes, okay? And the other copy comes from the lazy guy on the sofa, okay? So why am I doing this to myself? If I was a parthenogenetic animal, these two children would have two copies of my genes. Now, of course, you can say, all right, I mean, that you need support and protection in order to raise your children, all right. That's true enough, but it doesn't hold for 99.99% of the species, okay? So why do they do it, okay? And there must be some other explanations. And I think I'll persuade you what the explanation is. All right. Another issue, evolution in computer science practice. Computer science practice, actually, particular heuristics that, computer scientists write have been deeply influenced by evolution. So in order to solve an optimization problem, you create a population of solutions. You think of them as genotypes, where the components of the solutions are genes. The variants of the components are alleles. And a solution is a genotype who procreate, multiply through genotype recombination. And they multiply with success. The fitness of every genotype is proportional to the objective function value. In other words, what you are trying to maximize, you assume that's the fitness. And as a result, eventually, some very good solutions are bound to arise in the soup. Okay? So that's the theory. And there have been many thousands, probably tens or hundreds of thousands of algorithms built along these lines. On the other hand, there is another idea from evolution, but this one is influenced by asexual evolution. That's called simulated annealing. Basically, mutations are adopted with probability increasing with fitness and objective and the differentiation of the objective, and decreasing with time. So, and after a few generations, a good solution should arise. And the amazing thing is the following, simulated annealing works in practice. Okay, there are practitioners who swear by it, who use it to solve particularly well-known hard problems. And genetic algorithms don't work. Okay, and every time I say this, I make enemies in the audience. Okay, but believe me, it's true. And in fact, we know now why. Okay, and by this I mean that I know of no single problem for which a lot of approaches have been tried, and genetic algorithms have come up to be the best tried. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. And that's a mystery, because in nature the opposite happens. Sex is successful and ubiquitous. Okay, so if you look at the tree of life, okay, imagine 50 million species or whatever. Okay, there is an asexual species here, one here, one here, one here, one there. Okay, so they are very rare. Number one. Number two, even if you look at them, they are not asexual because of ancestry. Their ancestors were sexual, who lost it. Okay, there is no ancestral sexual species that has survived today. Okay, so how come nature's favorite trick, when programmed on a computer, fails? Okay, that's a great mystery to me. This is the mystery I explained to a biologist, Adil Ivnat, who came to Berkeley as a postdoc five years ago. And on our first meeting, we started talking about evolution and computer science. That was my first encounter with evolution. And I mentioned to him this mystery. And by the end of our meeting, we had come up with the following radical idea. What if sex is a mediocre optimizer of fitness? In other words, if that's not the point of sex. Sex is not a good optimizer of fitness. What if it optimizes something else? And that, what if something else is its role in evolution? Okay, so that's the conjecture. And we thought about it, and we came up with something called mixability. In a paper that we wrote together with Marcus Feldman, a great researcher in evolution who specializes in the theory of sex from Stanford, we established through simulations, you know, there are some much more persuasive results now, but I want to start with this, that natural selection under sex optimizes fitness as expected. In other words, without sex, fitness is optimized, but under sex, it optimizes mixability, and mixability of an allele, of a variant of a gene, is the following, is the ability of an allele to perform well, in other words, to perform well when it's combined with a lot of other genes. In other words, not to perform well in a specialized environment, but in general, all right? That's what mixability means. And so let me explain what mixability means. Imagine, so this is an imaginary animal with two genes, okay? The row and the column. The row gene has four alleles, four variants. The column gene has five alleles, five variants. And these numbers here are the fitness. So it means that this genotype is likely to produce three children, okay? Whereas this genotype, only one child, and this is going to be sterile, all right? And now, the point is, provably, asexual reproduction is going to select the biggest numbers in this matrix, okay, and run away with them. And this will dominate the population eventually. But under sex, what will happen is that the rows and columns with the biggest average will be, and that's what I mean by mixability, the biggest average of a gene. Average, of course, the plot thickens, it becomes a little more complicated. Average weighted by the probabilities, by the frequencies of the various genes. But that's essentially what it says, that it's going to be that the biggest averages will be selected. Okay? And it turns out that this is true, okay? That this happens by simulations, because it's very hard to prove something in this business because the equations are very nonlinear. But I'll show you what we did recently. And that's what we did by simulations, by essentially working on the same equations that Wright and Fisher had come up with 90 years ago, and biologists had used as our standard way of understanding evolution ever since then. All right, so that's mixability. Let me change the subject. Let me tell you something else. Now I'm going to tell you some interesting thoughts, computer science related thoughts about how new traits arise, how new non-existing before characters arise. And I don't know if you know about pointer dogs, but pointer dogs are amazing animals. They're hunting dogs. They have a pointer dog in this room would go crazy, because what they do is, if there is a living organism, if there is an animal in their environment, they would point to it, okay? And this particular animal is pointing to young Charles Darwin, okay? You know, this animal, on the other hand, is pointing on Cyril Waddington, okay? Cyril Waddington is probably the greatest experimental biologist of the 20th century. And in 1952, he carried the following experiment. He had a bunch of flies in room temperature, and then he raised the temperature to hot, and he noticed that a few flies, something like 15%, changed. The change had something to do with the appearance of their wings, but let's say the head became red, okay? So that I can show you. So a few of them changed. Then what he did is he took these and bred them, okay? He only chose the flies that were red, okay? And bred them. And then, lo and behold, the next generation, 60% were changed. Okay? And then he kept picking the red ones and breeding them. And every generation, more and more were breeding, until the generation 20, almost all of them had changed. Okay, that's an interesting experiment already. But then he did something really amazing. He lowered, all this time he had kept the temperature high. Now he lowered the temperature, and the amazing thing is that about 25% remained changed. Okay? Which really defies explanation. Okay? You know, this is really counterintuitive. It's like the following story, that a Norwegian couple will go to southern Crete for vacation, all right? I mean, you know, they become very dark, all right? I mean, you know, after a whole summer there. Then they go back to Norway, and 3 years later they have a child that is very dark. Okay, so you know this cannot happen, all right? I mean, so you know, how come it happens to the flies? You know, basically because their ancestor had gone through a hot period. Why do these flies? It cannot be mutation, right? Mutations don't happen, right? I mean, you know, mutations don't happen in 20 generations. It's possible something else is happening. Okay, so the question is. Is there a genetic, so this is in some sense the ghost of Lamarck, okay? You know, but don't worry, okay? Is there a genetic explanation? So what I'm asking is the following. So you can do this mathematical. You can say, can you find a function, a Boolean function, f of x, y? X is a vector of Boolean variables, y of x and h is another Boolean variable, which means high temperature, right? So can you find such a Boolean function that has the following property? That initially, probability under the initial population, probability of the population, let's say 50, 50, 0, 1, the probability that a function of, the f of xh with h equals 0 equals 1, is about 0%. Nobody has it. But then, if you raise the temperature, about 15% have it. And then, if you're breeding, 60% have it. a little above 50%, let's say. And then after successive breedings, keeping the temperature always high, of course, then almost all have it. And then if you turn down the temperature, enough of them will have it. Okay, so the answer is yes. Okay, so there is a, no, there is a, such a function. The sex function is, imagine that you have 10 genes and a high temperature bit, and what you want is that the sum of these plus 3 times h to be at least 10. Okay, it's a very simple solution. And you go through the steps and you persuade yourself that yes, all everything I mentioned to you happens, including the jump from 15% to 60% after the first breeding. And in other words, all properties of the Waddington experiment are satisfied. Okay. This was interesting to me. But what is more interesting to me is to try to generalize it to arbitrary Boolean function. Imagine there is a mysterious, unanticipated Boolean function. Let's call it I. Okay, where if all genes happen to have this Boolean function, there is a small advantage. All right. It turns out that we have the following conjecture. It's a conjecture in the theory of Boolean function. I think it's a deep conjecture in the theory of Boolean function. It says the following. Any Boolean function of genes which confers an evolutionary advantage will be eventually fixed. In other words, the whole population is going to have it. Okay? And you can prove it for monotone functions. And that's joint work with Livnat Valley and Andrew Wong. But my point here is the following, that this is... what this visualizes, and what you can prove it for monotone functions like the one I showed you before, is the following, that slowly in the whole population, with sex, that's important, and without mutations, okay, a new unanticipated function can emerge slowly so that everybody has it. Okay? The whole population has it. That's not like what Fisher and Wright said. Fisher and Wright were visualizing evolution as follows, that a mutation happens somewhere, because it has an advantage, it slowly spreads, and then the whole population has it. What I'm saying is completely different. The whole population has it. You know, the whole population rises with it. Okay? Not, and this, I think, by the way, is the flow of genetic algorithms. Genetic algorithms, what we try to do in heuristics is to create a soup in which a few individual solutions will be excellent. Okay? Evolution does not do that. Evolution creates a soup, a population, where the whole population is good. Not excellent, but the whole population is good. So evolution does a very different job than what we want in heuristics. All right? Okay. So let's let me. So the interpretation is this: that if there is a Boolean combination of a modestly large number of genes that creates an unanticipated trait conferring even a small advantage, then this combination will be discovered and eventually fixed in the population. So to put it in a bite size with sex, all moderate-sized Boolean functions are evolvable. Okay, in contrast to what the variance theory predicts without sex. Okay, I'm changing the subject again. I want to just point out to you the following, that in the 1970s, Kimura came up with a very influential theory in evolution, which is called the neutral theory. And the neutral theory says that evolution does not proceed in huge leaps, but proceeds slowly, and essentially by statistical drift. Okay, so you know, this has been amended many times, but it is at the center of discourse in evolution. It has been doubted, it has been strengthened by recent findings that basically show that in genomes there is a lot of variance, okay, variation, only a neutral theory can explain variation, even though recently there have been also genetic findings that dispute it. But This is certainly a theory that is in the middle of evolutionary discourse, very widely accepted. And there is a mathematical incarnation of this theory, which is that the values of the fitness matrix, in other words, these 8s and 3s and 4s and 2s and 0s that I showed you, are basically numbers that are very close to one another. Let's say that they're in the interval 1 minus epsilon, 1 plus epsilon. Okay, then what happens? That's the question. Okay, so, and now I'm completely changing the subject, okay? I'll talk about something completely different. Many, have you thought about this, Bernard?
No.
Okay, okay. So this is, a very simple problem to explain, okay? Imagine that it's called the experts problem. Imagine that every day, you can choose one of N experts, okay? Just to make it a little more natural and a little more American, let's say that they are financial advisors, okay? You know, who are trying to convince you to basically to select one particular stock, okay? So every day you get in the mail N advices, N pieces of advice, okay? So you know, buy this, sell this, buy this, buy this, okay? So what do you do? The advice in one day results in a gain, which is in the interval minus 1 plus 1. Okay, so you may lose, you may win. All right, so, and here is your ambition. Your ambition is an unreasonable one. What you want to do is, you never want to say, ah, I should have chosen expert 3 from day 1. Okay, in other words, if an expert is better than the rest, the way you are going to do in the end will not be different from this expert, as if you had followed this expert's advice day after day after day after day after day. Okay? So this is your ambition. You want to do as well as you had foresight and knew who is the best expert. And from then on, you followed his advice all the time. Of course, we all know that we cannot do as well as choosing the best expert of the day, okay? But the best overall expert, that's what we are going to do. And the amazing thing can be done. And it has been discovered many times. First an economist discovered it in 58, then a control theorist named Tom Carver, whom we lost recently, discovered it in 80, he published it in Financial Mathematics. Then people in AI discovered it, then people in AI discovered it again, then people in game theory discovered it, and computer scientists discovered it. They call it the multiplicative weight updates algorithm, okay? And I'm going to tell you what the algorithm is, because it's a very simple algorithm. So here's what it says. Initially, it's going to be randomized, because you have watched Bernard's lecture, you know that the randomization helps. So it's a randomized algorithm. Initially, you assign every expert probability 1 over n, equal probability. Let's say you assign weight 1 to each one of them. At each step, you increase the weight of each by multiplying it by this number. What is this number? This number is 1 plus epsilon, a very small constant, times the gain that this expert would offer you today. Okay, so in the end of the day, you read the paper, you see how much this expert will offer you, and then you increase a little the ones that did well, would have done well, and you decrease a little the ones that you have done well, worse, and then you renormalize so that you have a distribution. And that's the whole algorithm. There is nothing else to it. The amazing theorem is that this algorithm will give you an expectation, will perform as well as the best expert. Okay, very hard to believe. How many of you have seen this algorithm before? Okay, all right, I'm asking the rest. How many of you believe this? Okay? It's impossible to believe. Okay, so, you know, thanks for being credulous. Okay, I'm joking. No, it's true, actually. Yeah, so that's, it does as well, oh, sorry. It does as well as the best expert. The most amazing thing is that this is only—it's very simple to explain application. This algorithm solves all the most sophisticated problems in the world. Okay? You can solve zero-sum games, finds the min-max, linear programming, convex programming, network conjecture. There is a list of about 24 problems in AI, computer science, optimization, everywhere, that this amazingly simple, again, algorithm solves. Okay? Computer scientists don't believe this, okay? So, you know, it's really very hard to believe. And here I want to compare it with Darwin's doubt, okay? Darwin wrote that, I have to admit that the eye to this day gives me a cold shudder. Okay, you know, my belief that the eye evolved with my mechanism, the mechanism I suggested, is very hard for me to bear. Okay, that's what Darwin himself said. Okay, and actually, all evolutionary thinkers thinks about that. Okay, so let me. So the amazing thing is that these two mysteries are one. Okay, so here is what we can prove. That's Eric Chastain, who is a student or graduate student at Rutgers. Adi Livnat, who is now a professor at Virginia Tech. Myself and my colleague Umesh Vazirani. So you can find this paper in the archive. Under weak selection, evolution is a game. Under weak selection, I mean under the assumption that the fitness values are close to one another. Okay? Evolution is a game. When I say evolution is a game, I mean that the equations of Fisher and Wright for evolution are tantamount to the equations governing the play of a game. Let me explain the game. The players of the game are the genes. Okay? The strategies of every gene is its alleles. Okay? So the common utility, so they all have a common utility. So in other words, this is not a real game. Their interests are completely aligned. They are all interested in maximizing the fitness of the expected fitness of the resulting organisms. Okay? So they have, it's a coordination game, as these games are called. Okay? We have all have the same interest, we just want to agree to go to the same solution. The probabilities with which they play the strategies are the frequency of the alleles in the population. In other words, the population is used as storage to store the state of the game. The game is played through multiplicative updates, this miraculous algorithm. Not because this is the best thing to do, but because that's what nature does. Or at least that's what the equations of Fisher and Wright tell us that nature does. Okay? So that's the theorem. It says basically that these two mysteries, why multiplicative updates work, why evolution works, are one mystery. So let's recall the update here, this update, in the context of this game. The epsilon here is the selection strength. In other words, remember that what I told you, that fitness is in the interval 1 minus epsilon, 1 plus epsilon. Epsilon is the selection strength. And amazingly, this factor by which the frequency of every allele is multiplied is precisely the allele's mixability, okay? What we had defined in our paper 5 years ago as mixability. In other words, its ability to mix well with other alleles. Also, another important problem in evolution is variance preservation. In other words, you select, but if you select things, of course, you decrease the variance, okay? So how is variance preserved? And it turns out that there is a theorem that says that the multiplicative updates algorithm maximizes entropy. In other words, it preserves variance by itself. And the smaller the epsilon, the more entropy is maximized. So in some sense, to my mind, these are two mysteries that are united. Okay? The mystery of multiplicative updates and the mystery of how come evolution works. Uniting mysteries is what computer scientists do, okay? So Dick Karp, 40 years ago, united 23 mysteries, okay? That's how he created NP-completeness. But my point is different, okay? We united two mysteries, one of which is one of the most important mysteries in science, and the other one has a mathematical proof. Okay, because for multiplicative updates, you have a mathematical proof. Mathematical proof is that it's beyond any rational doubt. Okay? And to my mind, if people were looking for the role of sex in evolution, this is the role of sex in evolution. It enables the multiplicative updates algorithm in evolution. Okay. To recapitulate, the theory of life is deep and fascinating. I believe that that insights of an algorithmic nature can help progress. Amazingly, evolution is a coordination game between genes played via multiplicative updates, which is a novel viewpoint that helps understand the central role of sex in evolution. Okay, thank you very much.